Thank you for the nice introduction. I'm indeed talking about quite a broad subject, but I also think that this subject can only be dealt with interdisciplinary. And it is also quite broad in terms of how familiar people are with different concepts. So I'm trying to give a little bit of an overview. I'm trying not to assume too much, and I'm trying to introduce a few theories how you could conceptualize the whole subject. Basically, I would be focusing on how our condition as human beings that are more and more moving towards a cyborgian state or more hybrid human beings, does affect hierarchies in our society. And of course, I will also going to be talking about gender there, a little bit about sexuality, some devices, and how these hierarchies might change. Probably also a little definition, because there are so many terms. If you're looking at the subject, we have robots, we have androids, we have gynoids, who are sort of female-connotated androids, and we have the cyborg. And cyborgs, the term has been coined by astronautics in the 60s, and it was argued that space travel required the development of self-regulating human-machine systems. And they were termed cyborgs from cybernetic technology and organism. And however, the term is not restricted to astronautics, of course, and robot beings that blur the distinction between humans and machines, they inhibit quite many science fiction novels and films, and we all know them, like Terminator, Blade Runner, Star Trek, RoboCop, and how they're all called. And also, above all, the cyborg derives its intellectual influence from Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto, and I would be talking a little bit about that later on. So what interests me are synthetic but also incomplete and hybrid bodies. And I'm looking at the extension of human bodies by artificial constructs, and that can be via information or communication tools. And if you look at that, it's kind of interesting how to classify these extensions. You can classify it as surrogate, as compensation, as addition, or even as completion. And depending on how we see them is also our sense of self, our perception of what is human. And this is again tied to legal and ethical questions. Some of the ethical questions I will also address later. And also, there could also be this distinction between sending and receiving tools, which is relevant in prosthesis research and in medicine as well. As for the disciplines, there is a whole range of cultural studies theories, like different cyborg manifestos, like theories of the post-cyborg, recently even of the post-cyborg area. So we always have these post-terms. Probably if we're getting to a stage where we don't really know how to define the things that are coming up, we're going to put another post on it. But it's also, it's also related to science fiction, to futurologies, and to research on prosthetics, things like that. There is also this concept of a natural artificiality, as a theory of, more complete human beings. It's an anthropological, theory by Helmut Plessner. Who said that man, they are forced to execute and thus need a complement of non-natural kind by nature. So men have to complete themselves and to do this with things they create. And only by doing so, mankind can free themselves from this very eccentric nature. I find this a very interesting thought, when we are looking at cyborg creatures. So why do these bodies interest me? I'm coming from quite a feminist queer perspective, and they are very, very interesting in this regard. They have quite a potential, an anti-normative one, also a queer potential probably. And this potential is expressed, in very irritating means, sometimes ironically, sometimes very transcending and pointing the way ahead. So I'll discuss both potential and problems, with you to these questions of hierarchy within society, like social classes, gender, sexuality, and health. When we're thinking of cyborgs, we are thinking of computers and technologies, but there are also earlier forms, which you could probably call cyborgs. Wooden eyes, why do you stare at me like this? This is coming from Pinocchio scene. And there is this theme of a creature becoming alive, or like, a tool becoming alive. I think it's pretty much the same. Or the other quote is from Kafka's The Penal Colony, where the uncanny of a machine is taking over, and so it's not considered to be cool, ethical, or intended to give up control by humans. Not yet. So in The Penal Colony, it says it's up to this point, I had to do some work by hand, but from now on, the apparatus should work entirely on its own. Another interesting example would be Skynet in Terminator. So Skynet is this fictional self-aware intelligence systems that features very centrally in the Terminator franchise. And the Skynet operations are mostly exclusively performed by war machines or cyborgs, so usually a Terminator, and other computer systems. And the ultimate goal of this is the extinction of the human race. This is a quote from a censor dialogue from the script from Terminator 2. It is also displaying this fear. Also in the 80s, there have been certain declarations, and it was declared that there should be a clear distinction, a clear difference between humankind and machines. It was done by companies. So there's something like the IBM Pollyanna principle. And this states that machines should work and people should think. It's kind of interesting. On one hand, you can see there's a statement of optimism. So machines should do all the hard work, freeing people to think. Or they could also be seen as a very cynical statement. So that most of the world's major problems are resulting from machines that fail to work and people who fail to think. I have kind of problem with it because I also think that brain work is work and can be quite hard work sometimes. And I don't know. I don't know whether work should be framed like such a bad thing. Anyway, and luckily enough, some people have been examining the potential of more hybrid forms of existence of bodies. And there are certain visions connected to synthetic bodies and to cyborgs. You can summarize them like that. So I've been mentioning the anti-normative potentials. There's also this vision of the integration of artificial intelligence in our life work, like you find it in the whole cyberpunk genre. There's a certain vision of thought reading, so the creation of some sort of psychopathological philosophic spaces, or what we already found, the simulation of the human. So there's a few examples we already know, like the Jeopardy 2010 or the Deep Blue chess computer. So these are all these visions coming from the transhumanism or post-humanism field. Yeah, I'll be talking about post-sex later on. when looking at genoids or cyborgs who resemble human beings, I find this very interesting. This is the uncanny valley graph, and what it basically says that whereas the robot is clearly visible as an artificial project, and androids resemble more human beings. And I think this is very fine to apply to androids, genoids, and cyborgs, because it measures the sympathy we have towards a figure related to the level of human appearance. So if a humanoid robot or a genoid is clearly sensible and visible and displaying some human qualities, we find that very nice and positively. But the more we get more of a problem, the more realistic it gets, so then we find it a bit uncanny. And because the creature's got a certain deficit, so we find it a bit scary. And later, if these deficits are very limited or in existence, like a perfect human copy, then the sympathy increases again. I've been looking it up because I was interested in the simulations you sometimes find at airports, and you see all these simulations, what you have to do. And I was wondering why there wasn't, they weren't always so realistic. So maybe it's got to do a little bit with that. So the designers tried to not to frighten us too much, probably. And some researchers also have been pulling back from the research on robots because the whole thing became a bit too uncanny. Or there was this Elisa computer where, you probably know that anyways. So, when we're looking at the gender connotations of these creatures, it's no coincidence that the first female android was produced by a sex industry, and the term chinerit was first used to describe a robot slave in futuristic China that was measured by its beauty. That book was called Divine Endurance. And there's also this symptom of lustless programming. I'll give one example later. And with we find this othering of women in two scenarios. So on one hand, there's this focus on the needs women fulfill, which we could call objectification. And then there's a focus on limited roles, which we call usually fetishization. As a list of female robots and cyborgs for those who are interested on Wikipedia, I can really recommend. So how could these, how do these chinerits look like today? They look a bit like that, like the perfect secretary, they are sometimes called, from Actuate, from the company Sanrio. So this is one example. Of course, there are many others. Sometimes they don't have hair. Sometimes they look a bit less female. But generally, there is a tendency towards displaying them in a very female manner. They can also look like that. I just want to point out that this one is a painting, so this is not a real robot, but I find it very interesting in terms of how, in terms of what sort of fantasies we have, how female androids should look like. And, the other two pictures are our YouTube videos, actually advertisements of companies presenting their new creations. And it's kind of interesting. They can look more artificial. They can look more human-like, more sexy. There can be an emphasis on breasts or not, but it's all very, very female, I say. What is more interesting is the comments you find under these YouTube videos sometimes. Because every second comment, and it's really, really weird. I mean, YouTube comments are bad anyways, you know. But with this sort of videos, literally every second comment has got to do with sexuality, with penetration, with all sorts of things. I just quote these ones. So people write, does she come with a pre-fitted flashlight? Does she have a hole? She is so hot. Can it give blowjobs? Or clean the house, take care of all my needs, just the way I like it, won't bitch at me. If you prorate out the overall cost, it would be a lot cheaper. It would be even cheaper if they would produce naked. Or like stuff like, when do I get to fuck one? Probably a legitimate question. So, yeah, it's really fun to look at this, and I think it tells us pretty much about, about where we stand with feminism nowadays, so with this sort of fantasies. Another theory that plays in there is, of course, prosthesis and extension of human bodies. There are two things very revealing. On one hand, what is displayed in media and how people perceive themselves and their bodies when they are wearing such devices. There's already pretty many things we already have. We have pacemakers, we have the cochlear implant, which is the ear implant. There's been certain cases in the Paralympics where people were provided with a complete spine. So maybe in a few centuries, we will not accept the disability in a wheelchair anymore. We could think about it like that. And there's also, especially in media and in music culture, there's a lot of fetishization of prosthetics going on and a cult that is usually connected with ideals of beauty, but also with a criticism of these beauty ideals. One of the more well-known ones is Marilyn Manson. He's been playing a lot with it. And also Lady Gaga is kind of interesting because she's got this shoulder implantate there, you know, and that should basically irritate people. I don't know whether it should be an implant or a prosthesis. You don't really see it. And also in the fashion industry, we have a lot of pictures like that. Yeah, I find this quote very interesting from a fashion blog, or how do you call them? Fashion blogs, yeah. It takes a lot of courage to put beautiful people on crutches. Maybe we'll not take that much courage anymore in a few years. Another artist is Gerhard Aber, and he was fetishizing bodies with female prostheses. And his models, I've been at the exhibition, and his models always had a quite similar approach. You know, they were all they were dressed up in quite fetishized clothing. They were wearing extraordinary high heels on the other side of on the leg where they were not wearing the device. So this is quite an empowering way of looking at it. And also the right pictures, Amy Mullins. A model in that era, an actress. And she's rather well known as well, standing for that powerful female body. In the area of neuroprosthesis, we have several things going on already, and you probably know these news, they're always coming up. So Intel wants to connect smartphones with the brain, which raises a sort of a lot of ethical questions, because our brain can be extended by mobile tools. And computer companies are already researching that. There's this problem of reading our minds. There's implants. Actually, on the left side, this is models of mobiles that can be integrated into your skin, or that can be worn more closer to your body. And there's this, on the right side, there's this chip called VeriChip that was approved in the United States in 2004, but it was discontinued in 2010. And the device is like about twice of a dime. And it's usually worn, I think, over the elbow, between the elbow and the shoulder. It was widely criticized because it raised a whole data security discussion, because it lacked certain security features, and there was this risk of identity theft. You could read data out of it. You could scan. I mean, it goes into your body under your skin, and then you scan it, and then you take data out of the person. They insert it, I think, on the local anesthetics, and then I think it's like some sort of ID for you, which you could scan. I could use it. But like the Facebook ID card, but under your skin, probably. Yeah. The implantation wasn't the problem. I think the problem was that it came out, like the piercings sometimes come out, the surface piercings, and then there was this, there were certain privacy advocates that actually, yeah. So. Okay, getting to the theory and to the conceptualization of these bodies, there's been a lot. There's been several cyborg manifestos. I think the cyborg manifesto by Donna Haraway has been the most well-known one. The timestamps here are not so accurate, because I think I've been using the book once. Donna Haraway actually has been coming out in 1985, so please don't rely on that. And in this field, mostly, that's cultural studies and philosophies, binary oppositions are deconstructed. So oppositions like mankind, animal, organizing machines, things like that. And the cyborgian body is used as a means, as a method to do that. So that's been, I'm probably not going into detail into all of them, just that you heard of it. Donna Haraway is very interesting in this regard because she's always been quoted as the post-feminist theory in that area. And she's also doing a lot, her work is also dealing with the fusions with animals and machines and man, not only with cyborgs. So for her, the cyborg is a creature in a post-gender world, a way to overcome this dichotomy we had all the time. It's kind of interesting because that's been in the 80s, and people are sometimes asking what's in between, what did happen with the theory. And I think it is still a theory in the sense that we are still living in this binaries in our online worlds, in our technology worlds. You know, when we are entering a social networks, we immediately have to decide, we have to click female or male. So it's not really coming into practice. I think diaspora is a bit different when it comes to that. So, I don't know. The whole, it's still an utopia, I guess. So the cyborg as a hybrid of machine and organism, a creature of social reality and a creature of fiction, probably still stays this creature of fiction when it comes to the potential it would have. And also this potential, is not really so actively performed in the media representation of cyborgs yet. I give a few examples of media representations of more modern bodies or modern female bodies or cyborgs. One that is very well known is the TX, the Terminatrix. That's a female body of Sarah Connor in Terminator 3. And the TX has the ability to assume the appearance of other characters too. And the main thing about the design is that she is unlikely like previous Terminator models. I think she's very powerful and creative, but also in a sense needlessly sexually attractive. This is shown in the choice of her outfit. She's got this red, this low-cut red leather outfit with high heels. And I mean, the outfit is not especially sexual on its own, but the way she plays the takes that sort of allows the outfit to accentuate her female qualities, I think. She's very powerful, but the name, so she's called Terminatrix for a certain reason, I guess. So we are thinking of Dominatrix or a wording like that. However, the cyborg is always a metaphor for paradoxes and contradictions as well, so it's not so clear. Another interesting example are the Cylons of the Battlestar Galactica series. There are a few. I think this is number 6, and this is number 8. And again, you find this very female, very sexy appearance. powerful female ones. What is more interesting, are representations that are sort of blurring this female identity thing a little bit, that is sort of coming up with a different representation. I find Nemesis a very good example of this from the 90s. In part 2 of the Nemesis series, we find a genetically manipulated human being. But generally, there are very unconventional body representations here, different to the Terminatrix one, and different representations of feminine figures as well. So this cyborg called Alex, played by a bodybuilder, and she's very ambiguous and no clear gender is presented. A series of shots is showing belly, legs, and breasts that are very athletically defined, and with very dominant muscles, I think even with anabolic modified. And in part 4 of the series, which is called Cry of Angels, there's another Alex presented, And it's the same actress, and she's not genetically modified like the other ones, but a very hybrid structure of a body consisting of both organic and mechanic elements. And the mechanic parts are working against the limits of the body. You could relate it to theories of the abject by Yulia Kristeva, probably. And yeah, there's a sex scene in there where between Alex and a male cyborg, but a penis is inserted in the muscular abdominal wall, and then he is killed by Alex as well, and she's also killing another cyborg with metal stabbing weapons coming out of her nipples. So it's also quite a feminization of female characters. But this is not limited to a monstrous representation, there are several counteracts of this. For example, there's a very female appearance in other scenes, like this one, with the Marilyn Monroe dress and things like that. So it's no clear presentation. So I don't think that you can talk of a passive feminine object status of a rather male view here anymore. This is a creature oscillating between traditional gender binaries and being in transition, not really showing a clear gender identity. This picture is also very nice in this regard. Yeah. So what does this lead to in terms of our sexuality and our sexual activities? There's several people talking about this post-sex term, and that would be if our sexual desire and lust are becoming their own techno-stimulation. We had a little talk beforehand about what we could imagine doing this post-sex or cybersexuality. I think whatever you look up at the moment, there are still certain stereotypes dominant. Like there are certain applications you could play online. You can create your perfect sexual play body. And there was a talk of Doris Alhutter from the Institute for Technology Assessment, where she was talking about these different figures and applications, and she found that there's a difference between black and white bodies there. So you could put pain on these bodies, and it's kind of interesting that for the black bodies you could use far worse things. You could use more pain. You could do more harm to them than to the white bodies. So there's all these differences, but also stereotypes, as we know it. I think maybe in the lesbian context there is a potential. We are sort of acknowledging the prosthesis tool as having more potential than the organic part. And there's also research on the implementation of hydraulic erection devices. There's been one study examining 129 female to male transsexuals, and they said in the project report, in the study report, they stated there's no perfect solution yet. And they said because there's no good replacement of the corpus cavernosum, the Schwellkörper of the penis yet. And they say sexual organs, they see sexual organs as necessary. So I think the re-evaluation of sexual norms, the potential that some people have seen in the cyborg and in the whole prosthetic theory has stayed on the very surface here. It is completely in contrary to the theories emphasizing the deconstruction of a constructed character of body norms like Donna Haraway and others have been presented, and this is not acknowledged in studies out there yet. Some people are talking of a post cyborg and an area to say we are already post cyborgs. One of them is Steve Mann, and he's talking about a sickness of reality, a feeling of unplugged we are already facing. Maybe we already know that. And of course, there's also a political dimension in this theory. He's talking about the post-cyborg area of invisible computing as an antithesis to the surveillance structures of state and economy. It's when you read this theory, it's very hard to grasp because you can somehow not imagine how you would feel as a post-cyborg. So it's kind of hard to foresee these feelings. But what he would say, he's got this theory of reversed surveillance, he calls deconism. And he say we can work against this, against the state surveillance by deconstructing this, our post-human adaption phenomenon as a first step. So you can see it's kind of complicated. What is more interesting is how it looks like. So this guy has been living as a cyborg probably for 30 years because it didn't really take off his, helmet, which became more of glasses later on. And yeah, he sees being a cyborg for him is more a vision for a tomorrow that sees humanity freer, safer, and smarter in ways most of us can only imagine. That was 2001 already. So in this theory, the cyborg becomes the constitutional norm of the well-being, of the well-feeling, and the characteristic disease of our time would be that of an obedience deficit disorder, he calls it. Yes. But we can again work against this disease by other theories he's got. I'm gonna close by addressing two problems or the criticism some people had, because I've been talking about a lot of potentials. There's this very optimistic view of the cyborg, but there's also people who say that's a bit short-sighted, and sometimes it's anthropologists, sometimes it's people that are dealing with that are looking at how people really feel who are wearing these devices, so how people feeling that are that have a sort of prosthetic tool. And what I found so far, I've been looking at different descriptions of people wearing these tools, and I found that there's no common theory. It really depends on the personality. Some people say, I feel best if I don't feel my device. That's the best for me. And I don't wanna consciously feel it. Some people say, I wanna switch, you know, I wanna have my prosthesis tool and then I wanna switch to my crutches again. And some people have different situations for where there were different devices. So, I think it's very important that we don't use this concept of prosthetic impulses and of cyborgs too excessively, because this is what we would call a metaphorical opportunism. The metaphor of the cyborg and stuff like that is very interesting. It's very interesting to describe the conditions of our society, of our control society as well. But we should probably not use it speculatively. And we should also look at other studies like disability studies, because I think we have to connect these two theories. It doesn't really help us if we only look at cultural studies, philosophic theories. We also have to see what disability studies and what people who are really dealing with that sort of devices are feeling like. Of course, there's also a range of ethical dimensions and problems. Two problems are often highlighted, that is data security and manipulation. So probably, a patient could be hacked. This is what we've been discussing before. A person that is wearing an implant can be hacked. There's unauthorized access of devices. And of course, any wireless device is more risky. We know that. A technical solution would probably be if we could use certain frequencies for certain medical cases. I don't know. there's also medical risks that are not overcome yet. And that are like changes in the neural substance, which are related to questions of identity and individuality and would make manipulation possible. Also, when looking at medical risks, there's this question of pain. Because if we would have an external additional arm, let's say, Don't we also want to feel it? Don't we want to use pain as a sort of a warning signal? So these are questions that haven't been answered completely yet. At the moment, we have to make sure that it works, that we can use prosthetic devices connected to the brain. But maybe some changes of identity could also be okay for some, because for some brain-computer interfaces, we have to find out which brain functions are so meaningful that they would lead to an ethically problematic identity changes if we touch them. I think that is the question here. It will have an effect on our health definition and on our, the way we perceive ourselves, that's for sure. If we look at the definition of health in the Charter of the World Health Organization, we can find a very extensive one. So health here is a status of complete well-being. It's not only the absence of disease or disability. So we can subsume everything here. It's like a paradise-like vision, or feels more like it, and aging process seems to be suspended. So I think health is always based on a social context and has always a cultural dimension. So health also means that certain norms are not exceeded. So it's also defined by value judgment. And this is why sickness isolates us a little bit. We don't want to go public with that. So the consequence of becoming more machine man hybrids, the consequence of moving towards a cyborgian area, could be that our vision of being healthy is also seen as a acceleration, as an improvement of power, because we have more, we can recreate lost potentials, but we can also improve already existing potentials, and the difference sometimes is not quite so sure, so clear. I mean, maybe body functions will become more and more a question of design, of optimization. And like I said, we will probably not accept certain disabilities so easily in the future anymore. This could lead, and this is the most important point I want to make, whilst we have this potential of overcoming certain gender binaries, certain hierarchies in our society by using the cyber concept, we could create some other hierarchies, some new gaps in society. We could create a gap between the more healthy, who can afford these devices. And you can already see that with some devices. The cochlear implant I've been mentioning before is used by 30,000 people worldwide. Of course, it's also very expensive. But in that case, there is already a gap between the hearing and the deaf cultures, because some say much of the deaf community has been very opposed to the device and believes that deafness represents a culture and not a disease and not a disability. And there is no need to try and fix it even. This is probably a bit different, than the visual prosthesis for persons. But, it could definitely create new gaps in our society. When we are asking the question whether these devices should be accessible and available by all humans. So, speaking of a digital gap and so on. Again, this could be related to the biopower concept by Foucault. He relates this problem to questions of the state and the regulation of subjects, by achieving the subjugation of bodies and the control of certain populations. But I think, giving the time, I will not gonna go into detail. This is just a few selections of the problem we could face and the possible downsides of this otherwise very potential figure. Thank you very much.